This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time now to say hello again to University of Michigan physician and medical historian Dr. Howard Markel. He's with us to put a well-deserved spotlight on the work of one of the great American women in medicine, Dr. Alice Hamilton, the founding mother of occupational medicine. And I know this week marks the 45th anniversary of Dr. Hamilton's death, and she almost made it to age 101. So she really lived and worked over a span of time where she could break a lot of ground as a physician and as a woman.
Just an incredible lifespan from the mid to late 19th century all the way to 1970. So can you imagine the changes in medicine, technology, even the beginning changes of women in the workplace? Because she was a great pioneer as a female physician when there were not too many of them.
And you describe her achievements as magnificent, and that is not a word that I have seen you toss around lightly.
She's in that category.
Why?
To begin with, she was very interested in something called the social gospel movement, which was a religious movement in the late 19th century where people wanted to apply their religious faith, they were Christians, to improving the American society, helping immigrants assimilate, helping the downtrodden get homes or jobs or things like that. And so she became very enamored with the women who founded Hull House, where she later worked and lived for about 22 years, and decided she wanted to become a doctor. Well, you know, she graduated, by the way, from the University of Michigan in 1893, and there are wonderful photographs that we have in our Bentley Historical Library of her in action in laboratories, mm-hmm. in the classroom, as well as just a stunning graduation shot. But there were not many women entering medicine in 1893. Michigan was one of the few schools that was accepting women into its medical school. It started in the 1870s. So she was at the right place at the right time. And she also made sure she had all the accomplishments to be a first-rate physician and researcher and scholar. She went to all the right places. She went to a training program at University of Minnesota and then to Boston. She spent time at Johns Hopkins and in the laboratories of Leipzig. And then when she came back to Chicago in 1897 to work at the Northwestern Women's Medical College, as well as Hull House, she was the very model of a major physician. Yet she had a hard time getting regular gigs because of her gender.
In fact, she joined the faculty of Harvard even at a point when women were not being admitted to the faculty of Harvard.
She was the first woman appointed to the Harvard faculty. Yes. It was a part-time appointment, and she was a lifelong assistant professor. So I always jibe my Harvard colleagues when they brag, you know, we had a female member of the faculty. Well, yeah, but you didn't treat her all that well. And she also said famously, because it was a big news story in 1919 when she got this position. She said, I may have been the first woman appointed, but I wasn't the first woman who deserved to be appointed. And so she had that credential as well as working at Hull House in Chicago. And occupational or industrial medicine was not a sexy field back then. It was hardly a field at all.
I'm sure that was not a concern of any of the owners of the factories that were being filled by largely immigrants coming to because of the Industrial Revolution.
Not at all. This was the era of the robber baron, and it was pre-union, and you know, foundries, lead paint factories,
fires in factories.
Any industrial factory was. These were very unsafe places to work. There were also a lot of children, by the way, working in the workplace, and because they had nimble fingers and things like that. And before the early 1900 child labor laws, there were just scads of injuries to children. And she not only secreted herself as a sort of a secret agent to get into these factories to observe firsthand what was dangerous, she also was well-schooled enough in chemistry and toxicology to do studies, you know, what does exposure to picric acid do to you or lead paint do to you or a variety of other toxins that we now know to be very deadly. And she wrote these elegant reports. She worked for the U.S. Department of Labor as well that are just a model of elegance. They're still very wonderful to read and good sense and, in fact, saved a lot of people's lives in a very different way.
So she did move the needle.
She did. She did. There were changes. There weren't as many as she would have liked. She spent her entire career, as she called her autobiography, exploring the dangerous trades. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. And she did move the needle, but we still have many problems both in the United States and abroad, and especially as you know, there are more and more places abroad that have very cheap laborers. Some would call them slave laborers. Mm-hmm. And we have this demand in the developed world, including the United States, of wanting cheaper and cheaper goods, but not really caring where it comes from or how it's made. Alice Hamilton's work, I think she would say, is still undone. There's still much more work to be done, she would say.
The thing that also interested me is that as she was at Hull House, she also, with this bottomless source of energy she seemed to have, she tackled cocaine abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sounds very contemporary. And here she was, you know, in the late 1800s, the turn of the century, dealing with cocaine abuse.
Huge problem. Cocaine was easily purchased over the counter. It was in a number of products, including Coca-Cola. And it was you could get coca wine and coca lozenges. And there was then, as now, a huge potential for abuse. It wasn't until 1914 when the Harrison Narcotics Control Act was passed that it became a controlled substance. So she found a lot of problems. And even after that, by the way, if you ever look at Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, and he's in jail. Another convict next to him slips some cocaine. He doesn't want to get discovered, so he slips some cocaine into Charlie's salt shaker. And Charlie Chaplin on cocaine is, or acting as if he's on cocaine, is a truly remarkable moment in the history of film. But it was, you know, even we've talked about Cole Porter and the song "I Get a Kick Out of You." You know, I get no kicks from cocaine. So it was a drug of abuse, and she was on that case as well.
When you think of who is doing this kind of work now and what she began, the seeds she planted.
Yeah.
And as you say, 45 years after her death, she would still have a lot to fight about, wouldn't she?
She would. There was one remarkable moment. You know, she would, as I said, she would get into these mines. And think about becoming a double agent in a mine, but you're also a woman. Coal mines, copper mines. And there was one time where she had very bad living facilities at night. They were just basically sheds. And a miner came into her cubicle thinking she was a prostitute. And she quickly disavowed him of that notion.
Yeah. No.
But she was interviewed in the 1960s about that. And she shrugged her shoulder and said, you know, I used to have to do those kind of things. But she was a magnificent woman. And we are all safer because of her. Of her industry in exploring the dangerous trades.
Dr. Howard Markell is a University of Michigan physician and medical historian and a regular contributor to PBS NewsHour. Always great to have you with us.
It's always my pleasure, Cindy.